Welcome to WJBC This Week.
We love Illinois. We love Illinois.
This is not tolerable. This is unacceptable.
A car description isn't enough.
We've never run out of balance. I think emotions are running high at ISU.
They help make Bloomington normal what it is today off of their labor and their hard work.
Some of the changes after 9/11 to the President's Daily Brief were amazing. I lived through those.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, Donald Trump brings his presidential campaign to Bloomington days before the Illinois primary in the aftermath of the Trump rally. Cemetery grounds and headstones were damaged by overflow parking. We'll hear from a local man whose son was buried there, and he volunteered to help the cleanup effort. Senator Dick Durbin assesses Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders' hopes of winning the White House. A Supreme Court scholar assesses President Obama's nominee and Republican efforts to block a hearing. A McLean County native and former intelligence officer discusses his book on the president's so-called Book of Secrets. Plus, sports writer Ben Strauss on the big business of college athletics and the problematic nature of the amateur status of players. That and more coming up this WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. 2 days after security concerns prompted Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump to cancel a scheduled rally in Chicago, a political event in Bloomington was relatively civil. The GOP frontrunner spoke to a crowd of about 2,800 people at Synergy Flight Center in Bloomington 2 days before Illinois' primary election. The entire 46-minute speech can be heard at WJBC.com. Here's an excerpt.
Do we love Illinois? We love Illinois. We love Illinois. So you have a big, big building in Chicago. You know that building, right? Trump International Hotel. Number one. Look at those people back there. Wow. Wow. Well, I want to thank you all for being here. We have a big, big week coming up. We have a big century coming up. We have a big decade coming up. We're going to do some things that are going to be amazing, and we're going to take our country back and make America great again. We're going to do it. So, thank you very much, folks. And on Tuesday, you have to do one little thing. Go out and vote. You know, we have, and it's not me, it's we. We have a movement going on that's not seen before. I mean, they have not seen, even the media, the very dishonest media will tell you, there has never been anything like we have going. Never. Never happened before to this extent. And you see it in the primaries. You see it in the polls. You see it all the time. You see it in the polls. Millions of additional people are going to vote. Millions on the Republican side. And they're not by the way, I have to be honest. It's not for Marco. It's not for Ted. It's for us. It's for us. So a lot of things are happening. And, you know, this all began in June when I said, got to do it. You can't take it anymore. You see what's going on. You see these horrible trade deals. You see the deal with Iran, maybe one of the worst deals I've ever seen of any kind. We give a terror nation, Iran, $150 billion. We get nothing. We get nothing. Those deals, it's not going to happen anymore, folks. Not going to happen anymore. You have your industry moving out. Illinois is a big example of it. You know how badly things are doing. I mean, you are a great example if you really think about it. Your taxes are through the roof. Your companies are leaving you. You got nothing going. We have nothing going throughout the country, largely. We have nothing going. We have higher taxes every year, higher taxes. And honestly, you guys are really one of the big factors. Ohio's not doing well. You know, Ohio likes to talk about how they've stabilized. What they've done in Ohio is raise everybody's real estate taxes so high that they're choking. And then they say, oh, we didn't raise taxes. No, they raised real estate taxes. And, you know, what he did is he approved NAFTA. NAFTA was the beginning of the end. Companies moved out, and Governor Kasich, you know, he went out. Kasich, he went out, and he approved NAFTA. And NAFTA was a disaster. Now he's in favor of TPP. TPP, think of it, TPP is even worse. It's going to kill so many businesses in our country, destroy our jobs. Folks, it's time to stop. We've got to use our head. Now, look, just so you understand how bad TPP is, and I'm just going to say it for a second because a lot of people, it's called Trans-Pacific Partnership. It is a disaster for our country. And what you have is you have other countries basically sucking away our money, sucking away our jobs. You're closing down your factories and your manufacturing plants, and we're going to stop it. We're going to keep our business here. We're going to bring our business back. We're going to bring jobs back to America, folks. We're bringing jobs back to America.
That was Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump at a rally in Bloomington. In the aftermath of the Trump rally, more than a dozen headstones and cemetery grounds were damaged at East Lawn Cemetery across the street from the rally. The cemetery became a makeshift parking lot for some rallygoers. Pictures were all over social media and upset many. Floyd Aper's son, Rob, a firefighter, is buried there. Floyd was among those who took time with local firefighters and other volunteers to assist in the cemetery cleanup. He talked with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
Tell us how the whole thing, the whole episode with people parking in the cemetery happened.
Well, assuming it was an overflow from the rally, without a doubt. And I got a call early yesterday afternoon from a Bloomington fireman that knew my son, who's a fireman, that was buried there last January, a year ago January, and wanted me to know and said there was damage out there. Didn't know how much or where, and immediately my wife and I went out there. And our markers were saved, God love it. But there you can see tracks there towards the south side of the cemetery where somebody had driven through there. And then over a little bit further to the north, there was more damage. And I called and or messaged the firefighter and thanked him and said my son's marker was okay and let me know if anything I could do. He said he had texted or called or emailed the union leaders of Normal Fire Department and Bloomington Fire Department. And it wasn't 2 or 3 minutes later he called me back and said, hey, we got guys on the way. We'll see you out there. And I went out there with my rake and a bottle of cleaner, what have you. And there was, I would say, 15 to 20 firemen from both Normal and Bloomington. We had shovels, rakes, brushes, water to clean some of the markers that were there. And it was very, very sad because it wasn't an accident. It wasn't something that somebody didn't know what they were doing. You could see the ruts, the tracks, the stones, not the stones, but the markers that had been run over and pushed into the ground. And it was very emotional and sad to think that we have people today that have no respect whatsoever for a cemetery. You wonder, you know, about people like that. But it's heartfelt to see firefighters coming together and doing what they could. And this morning, I know I got a call from East Lawn thanking us for what was done. And again, it's not me. It was the firefighters that put this together. I just had the honor to help. But they've had a call. They had a call from a landscaper today based upon social media saying, what do you need? We'll get it to you. So I know I went by earlier today. They're working out there trying to reconstruct, trying to fill the ruts, you know, and doing what they can to the markers. But again, it's just disheartening. I've probably had over 300 either reposting of the comments and or, you know, sharing comments. And people are upset. And there's good people in this world, and you saw them come out. But by the same token, you know, I'd like to see somebody come forward because there's no excuse whatsoever because it was daylight. Yeah, it was raining. But there was not one way. There's multiple ways in. But if they park there, you know, the roads aren't big enough for traffic going in two different directions, and with somebody left the event, didn't want to wait for the people in front of them and just took off through there, I don't know, but it's inexcusable without a doubt. And before we finished, there were people driving through based on what they heard, you know, checking family, loved mm-hmm. ones that were buried there. And I even had a call this morning and said, we're on our way just to check to see if it was damaged to, you know, their family.
Well, you know, and it's, and for you, Floyd, it's all of the parts of this story connect and intersect, because your son was a firefighter and he was somebody who was very close, and a lot of people in both fire departments knew him. In fact, I had lunch with my son, who's with Normal Fire, and he was wearing a T-shirt with your son's name on it last week. And when I saw your name pop up there, I said, you know, it's too bad that that's happened. I'm glad your son's grave was not affected. But here's the part of the story, I think, that makes this story even deeper. Tell us about your son, because anybody who had a grave that was damaged out there would be able to do the same thing. But this touched you because it was the cemetery where your son was buried.
We were in a panic, without a doubt, and it's hard to talk about. It was an accident, and he was enjoying his kids, and he ended up with a blood clot and passed away. But Rob was one that touched many, many, many lives. They loved him. That was his niche in life. He loved what he'd done. He was a joker, without a doubt. But every fireman that worked with him always said that he put a smile on their faces, and he touched a lot of young people. He was coaching baseball. He coached he was one of the medical team with the Bloomington Cardinal youth football. He was very instrumental there. He was on the board. He helped bring about the concussion testing for the young players that play football. He was always at the library on his day off and touched a lot of kids through the school. His son, oldest son, wrestled, and every wrestler knew him. And every wrestler got a hug, whether they won or lost.
Well, Floyd, I'll let you gather yourself here a minute. Let me just add a couple of things to this, is that I think it shows the true bond never ends between firemen and their brothers that are still working. And I think had it not been a fellow fireman who was buried there, who possibly could have had his grave run over by a car, I think the firemen still would have shown up. That's just the way firemen are. That's the way they're put together. That's just, they come and help. And I think the part of the story is I felt so bad that it was people that maybe I don't know, but the people who know the people who are buried there that had their markers run over. It was so senseless. There's no way to understand how this works. By the way, there are pictures of the cars with their license plates posted all over social media, and there'll be something done there.
That was Floyd Aper of Normal with Dan Swaney. McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers said this week he can only file charges if they can prove who is driving, not simply work off a license plate. As Donald Trump moves closer to the Republican nomination, WJBC's Scott Laughlin asked Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin this week about whether he could work with President Trump. They also discussed the financial problems plaguing Illinois' colleges and universities because of a lack of a state budget.
People around here are very, very frustrated.
Well, they should be angry, too. This has gone on too long. It's 9 months without a budget. Our state's never, ever been in this mess before. And when it comes to these MAP grants, which are given to low-income college students, worth a couple thousand dollars or $4,000, somewhere in that range, there are 130,000 kids in Illinois that count on it. And now they're being cut off. And the schools that count on the money coming in from the MAP grants are talking about closing their doors. Chicago State, you mentioned Eastern, yeah. Western, you know, and that isn't fair to the kids, their families, and it sure isn't fair to the schools from where I'm sitting. This has got to come to an end. I ran into the Catholic Archbishop up in Chicago over the weekend, big St. Patrick's Day stuff. he said by the end of this month, the state of Illinois will owe Catholic Charities in Chicago $30 million. He said, I can't keep the doors open. I have 4,000 social workers who do daycare for kids and visit and provide meals to the elderly and, you know, do things that are basic for folks that are struggling in their lives. And he said, I can't keep, subsidizing this payroll if the state's not going to pay what it's supposed to pay. Illinois, back in Springfield, the City Water, Light, and Power Utility, at one point was owed over $9 million by the state for electricity.
So we know what the problems are. What would you, if you had a chance, maybe you did, because a lot of us are blaming Mike Madigan for this, because the state of Illinois elected a Republican governor, and he wanted to change some things, and they liked that. They liked that idea. But he's being handcuffed by the Speaker of the House. Do you think that Mike Madigan has done all he can?
I think that there's room for blame all around. I'm not going to single them out. The governor is determined to change the laws in Illinois as they relate to labor unions. He said from the beginning, I disagree with him completely on this issue.
But he was elected with that.
He was, but you know what it boils down to is he's in the world of business, now he's in the world of politics, and he ought to look around at his board of directors. The General Assembly happens to disagree with him on this issue, including his own party. His own party isn't voting with him on this issue. So you reach a point where you say, Governor, this may be a great idea, but for goodness sakes, you can't, stop our state cold in its tracks over this idea. You know, it's reached a point, finger of blame in every direction. Put folks in the room, close the door, and tell them don't come out until there's an agreement. There are just too many innocent victims around our state. Kids going to college, daycare for kids in low-income families. I mean, the list goes on, and it really has to come to an end. I am so embarrassed for our state. I love the state, and what we're going through, our national reputation, is just unfair to the people of the state.
I am mocked by my out-of-state brothers and sisters. Mocked.
Yeah.
Real quick, on this election day, let me ask you this. Would you be able to work with a... Oh, boy, the gag reflex just kicked in. Would you be able to work with a President Trump?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I've never, ever, ever seen anybody on the American political scene like this. I've never seen any viable political candidate say the things that he does about people and groups. I've never seen that before.
Would you be able to work with a President Bernie Sanders?
Well, yes, but I will tell you that Bernie, my friend, my colleague in the Senate, and I can give all his speeches. I've heard him so often. He really believes it. Many of his ideas are over the moon. They are not going to happen. And this is the world where you have to compromise. As we just talked about the Illinois budget, you can't have everything you want. He's identified some things people really care about, the strength of Wall Street, the fact that people aren't making enough money, their paychecks aren't keeping up with their expenses, the fact that we want Social Security to be here for a long time. All these things are really solid, but you've got to look at the Congress and say, who are you working with? You may have to be ready to compromise in order to achieve anything.
That was Senator Dick Durbin with Scott Laughlin. President Obama introduced his Supreme Court nominee this week to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia, Chicago native and current appellate judge Merrick Garland. Illinois State University court expert Megan Leonard discusses Garland's prospects for getting a hearing and the key cases that are before the court now, as she talked with WJBC's Terry James this week.
What do you know about Judge Merrick Garland?
So what we know is that he's a moderate, he's center-left. Some people have called him the Kennedy of the liberals. We don't know all that much about where he stands on some of the more controversial issues, because when you're on the D.C. circuit, you deal with most cases are about government regulation. So we have some information about how he would decide, but maybe not a lot about those big issues like abortion or affirmative action. But he seems generally fairly moderate, very well-liked judge, who has served essentially in the highest judicial position you can be in that's not on the Supreme Court.
Well, it seems to me that we should maybe stop identifying them as left or right. And I mean, they're really there to interpret the law. It's supposed to be a nonpartisan position. Isn't that right?
It is true, and certainly the judges have judicial philosophies or ways that they view the law, and it's not necessarily bad that they're liberal or conservative or that they see the law in that way. The judges themselves aren't partisans. It's how then the partisan branches of government use the judges in a way that seems sort of uncouth or maybe something we don't want to associate with the judiciary.
Well, and with the Republicans right now fighting over whether or not they want the current leader to be their president, there's a lot of infighting there. And is it just a dislike for the president that you think may be causing this?
That's certainly driving a lot of it, and I think that they believe that this type of obstruction actually will win them voters in the fall, that there is enough dislike of the president in the public. Certainly the most important thing for any senator is to get reelected, so they have to be thinking about who their constituency is and how they might react, which is why we see some people not towing the party line and saying that they might at least meet with the judge because their constituents, for example, Mark Kirk in Illinois, may not be as supportive of an anti-Obama or completely obstructionist approach.
Well, and I think I even heard Lindsey Graham say that, hey, guys, we better not be so obstructionist because if Hillary is elected, she would pick someone that was even more liberal.
Certainly that's a possibility. I think as we get closer to November, the Republican Party might have to readjust their strategy. I don't know who's going to win the presidency, but if it seems increasingly likely that the Democrats or maybe Hillary will win, the Republicans may have to change their strategy. And certainly Merrick Garland is the best that they could get and much more moderate than a Hillary appointee if she has especially a Democratic Senate as well.
Now, something that's coming up, and I think no one would contest this is going to be a fight and maybe a long one at that. But there were already arguments made for several important cases, and June is when we may hear those results. Now, how's that going to come out? Would that be the possibility of a tie then on some of these issues?
Yeah, there will absolutely be a tie on some issues. There are issues like affirmative action and voting rights and abortion that seem sort of destined to have 4-4 decisions. Those decisions would go back to the lower court decision, and ultimately the Supreme Court wouldn't have a say in those issues until another case came up.
Do you see it? I mean, because the process to go through hearings and all that takes a long time anyway. Do you see it even being possible that Merrick Garland could be confirmed in time to be a part of these decisions?
No, certainly not. Not just because of the actual situation here, but any of the decisions that he didn't hear oral arguments on, that the justices have already started their majority opinions on, he very likely would not come in and vote on those cases. And because they stop hearing oral arguments in April or May, which is coming up very fast, he would really play no role even if he were confirmed tomorrow, except for on the last few cases of the term. Though, to be fair, that does include an abortion case, I'm sorry, a birth control case and an immigration case. More likely would be he would be confirmed in time to start the entire term next October when the next term starts.
That was Supreme Court scholar Megan Leonard with Terry James. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Illinois Wesleyan and Normal Community grad David Priest served as an intelligence officer under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. He was responsible for helping to compile the president's daily brief, which details the most important intelligence data. He discusses how presidents over the years have used the document and how it changed after 9/11. When he talked about his new book, The President's Book of Secrets, when he talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
Let's do a lightning round, shall we, and just talk about some of the presidents that have been... we started with Kennedy. Let's go with Richard Nixon.
Nixon was a tough character for many reasons, but the most interesting thing about him and his PDB is even with all the research I did, interviewing virtually everyone alive who worked with him closely, I'm still not sure if he read it. At first, Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor, had said he thought Nixon ignored it, but then he told me that he was sure that he read it, and he gave me some reasons why he believed so. But that's one of the big mysteries left open with the President's Book of Secrets.
Wow. And I want to go back to, was it Kennedy that said, do I have to read all of this?
Yes, when he was unable to sit still for those briefings,
yeah.
What his advisors started doing was simply giving him a large stack of documents from the CIA, the State Department, the Pentagon, and he looked at that stack and just couldn't believe he had to read all of it, and that's why they decided to give him one document that had everything he needed from an intelligence point of view.
Give it to me in one sheet. Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford. Mm-hmm. Gerald Ford came into office when President Nixon resigned, and he had been the first vice president to receive daily in-person briefings from the CIA of this document. So when he became president, he just shifted the real estate of those briefings from his kitchen table in Alexandria, Virginia, to the Oval Office itself, leading to a lot of good interaction.
You've talked about Jimmy Carter. Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan, by conventional wisdom, was not much of a reader, certainly not a reader of serious top-secret intelligence documents. The research debunks that myth. There's plenty of evidence that Reagan marked up his copies of the PDB, circling things, even finding typos. Those are not things that a casual reader does.
I imagine George H.W. Bush was not overwhelmed by it at all since he came from the CIA.
That's right. The first president and vice president before that to have been director of the CIA, he appears to have had a very close relationship with his president's daily brief with two notable results. One, he took an in-person briefing every day for his whole term, something even President Ford had not done. Secondly, he had a little bit of fun with his briefers. He took the book very seriously. It helped him do things like kick Iraq out of Kuwait and end the Cold War peacefully. But he also would do things like make wagers with his briefers about the way that elections were going to come out or have some humor put into the president's daily brief to balance the very serious content therein.
Really? Interesting. Now, I don't know how much you can talk about this, but you served under Clinton and George W. Bush.
That's correct.
That transition, we all know. So you were there on the events of September 11th and the days and
right.
months leading up to that. What can you tell
right.
us about that's not classified? Give me a little anecdote about that time.
Yeah, the Counterterrorism Center at the Central Intelligence Agency was at the forefront of the work before and after September 11th, and I had the privilege of working there. The efforts to get ahead of al-Qaeda and the terrorism issues before September 11th are documented in the book that led to perhaps the most famous President's Daily Brief item in history because it was declassified by the 9/11 Commission, and that was a piece that President George W. Bush received in August of 2001, saying, "Bin Laden determined to strike in the United States." The piece is very clear about the intent of al-Qaeda to strike in the United States, but it doesn't give a lot of details about the capability, and that's really what the commission focused on. Because of that, some of the changes after 9/11 to the president's daily brief were amazing. I lived through those, and I saw the increased attention to intelligence, the increased attention to how the pieces were put together to go in, and most notably, the increased attention to getting input from other intelligence agencies, such as the FBI, so that if a terrorism issue crossed the foreign domestic divide, the president's daily brief was able to include items from both agencies.
Wow, very interesting. Nixon didn't like the CIA. Kennedy yeah. didn't like the State Department. Was there or are there presidents that took it all in? I mean, they had a good relationship with the FBI, the CIA, the State Department.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me, at least the ones that I spoke with, all the living presidents, they all seem to appreciate the support they got, but recognize the constraints that came with it, because they know that not everything around the world can be known. So they were frustrated with what was not in the president's daily brief. But to a person, they appreciated what they did get and gave some acknowledgement of the fact they knew that this was a little bit of a tough job to get them everything they needed to know on a daily basis.
All right. Now, I don't want to get political, but I have a question because
sure.
we're in a campaign right now. All these candidates are all telling you, here's what I'd do with this, especially when it comes to foreign policy. When you hear candidates talk about what they would do if they were president, Does it ever make you cry? All the information I ever get is from the movies and your book now. But I'm thinking these guys don't have a clue as to what is really going on in the world, because that is intelligence that is privy to so few people.
Right.
Am I right or am I right?
Well, here's how I look at it. What you say as a candidate is very different than what you would say as president. Part of that is because the candidates have not received the president's daily brief yet. They do not receive daily intelligence briefings. So they're saying a lot of things about the world that might be changed once they see what the facts on the ground are and what the best assessment of the intelligence services are. But it is a valid question to ask, and it was unfortunate in my eyes that in all of the hundreds of debates and town halls that we've been seeing for the last few months, there was not a single question to any of the candidates about how they would receive their daily intelligence and how they planned to use the objective, timely, and hopefully accurate intelligence assessments they're receiving to inform their foreign policy. And that's a real question. Knowing how each candidate plans to preserve this channel of objective analysis would help Americans decide which ones are most likely to use their daily book of secrets most effectively.
Would a candidate?
And which ones would not?
That was author David Preece with Scott Laughlin. Major college athletics has become big business. Some student athletes could eventually cash in and make it big, but many don't and face other financial pitfalls. Sports writer Ben Strauss profiles the big business of college athletics, including an attempt by the Northwestern football team to unionize, as he talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
So what percentage of top division players make the pros and actually cash in?
Yeah, so that number is between 5 and 10%, which is sort of a fraction of the thousands of players out there playing on Saturdays and the fall on TV, and then the basketball players that'll play in March Madness.
So not a lot. But the thing is, these kids do get scholarships, and they get a lot of preferential treatment in school. And isn't that good enough for the trade-off? What's the argument to say that the system is really overly imbalanced?
Yeah, I think if that education was everything that folks would like it to be, you'd have a much better argument that this is a fair deal. But the truth is that education, number one, a lot of these kids come in unable to do college-level work. And number two, the education they get isn't that good. Look at what happened in North Carolina, where you had, you know, for 20 years, basketball and football players were being funneled into these fake classes that didn't meet and didn't prepare anybody for a life after college. And so that's not a isolated situation. You look at other schools where athletes are clustered in majors like fitness studies, and they spend 40, 50, 60 hours a week playing their sports. They're just not given the opportunity to take advantage of the education. And so this great college education that they're promised, in many cases, is not all it's cracked up to be, which is really unfortunate.
Well, not only that, but you write about some of the kids who get caught in the wheels of the system, players who get hurt, who lose their scholarships, who don't get what they feel they were promised once they aren't valuable to the team. Are they treated differently in this case than other students who aren't part of the athletics programs?
Well, yeah, because the football and men's basketball players are on campus to make money, especially at these Power Five schools like Alabama and Ohio State and USC. They're on campus to drive revenue. And, you know, we read about a kid at Oklahoma a few years ago who hurt his knee at practice one day. The doctors, the team told him it was fine, no problem. And for about a year, he tried to keep playing. And finally, his parents took him to get a second exam, and it turned out he had a torn meniscus. And then not only did Oklahoma refuse to pay for the surgery to fix his knee, but then they cut him because he was hurt.
There are people that are pushing back against this system. Let's talk about a couple of them. Tell us about the class action lawsuit that is being led by former UCLA player Ed O'Bannon.
So Ed O'Bannon, about 7 years ago, was at a friend's house, and somebody came up to him and said, "Hey, Ed, I saw you in a video game I was playing." And this was the NCAA basketball video game, and the avatar in the game wore the same number, looked the same, had the same shot as Ed O'Bannon. And Ed played basketball at UCLA in the mid-90s, and here he was, an older man. He was working at a car dealership in Las Vegas, and he thought, you know, this isn't right that they could use my name and my image and not compensate me for it. So in 2009, he filed a lawsuit against the NCAA, and it wound through the courts for 5 years, and in 2014, a federal judge ruled that the NCAA had violated antitrust laws, that the NCAA couldn't make rules that said schools couldn't share money with the athletes. Now, that's a very good thing from a legal standpoint, but practically what an appellate court did was say, you know, the system is okay, even though the rules themselves are illegal.
Talk a little bit about what's happened with Kane Coulter since he became the public face for the players and argued for this against his own school, against his own coach.
Yeah, it's really hard for 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who think they have professional careers ahead of them to try to rock this boat, to try to speak up against some of the inequities of the system. And this is what happened to Kane Coulter. He tried to rock the boat. He tried to speak out for athletes' rights, for health care, for better treatment for these guys. And he was sort of vilified on the Northwestern campus, as well as places around the country. There were former Northwestern players who wouldn't speak to him. There were coaches who wouldn't speak to him. He sort of became this pariah on the Northwestern campus after he had been the star quarterback for a number of years. And so his example is exactly why it's so hard for players to try to make meaningful change here.
That was sports writer Ben Strauss with Steve Fast. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Donald Trump found a less hostile crowd in his campaign visit to Bloomington than he had had in recent days, but there were a few disruptions during his 45-minute speech.
All right, get him out of here, please. Get him out.
Now, several times, the Republican presidential candidate stopped to point out those trying to disrupt the rally, often when the subject turned to immigration. And Trump's often repeated mantra that he wants to build a wall and will have Mexico pay for it. He suggests another presidential candidate is behind the protest.
Send them back to Bernie!
And Trump says his supporters got a bad rap. And peaceful protesters and loving supporters came to Bloomington to see Trump. WJBC's Terry James spoke with some spectators.
This man drove 2 hours after a Chicago Trump rally was postponed.
The Bernie people were taunting the Trump people, plus the Bernie people were saying vile things against the police.
There were more than 100 protesters like Alexis Swearingen.
He's just a bigot and awful and racist, and I really hope he doesn't become our president.
Trump ordered police to remove several protesters from the rally, but none were violent. Terry James, WJBC, and WJBC.com.
It's not certain whether anyone will ever be charged for the damage left at a cemetery following the Donald Trump rally. McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers says for his office to pursue charges, they have to identify the actual people who caused the damage.
A car description isn't enough, and a lot of times no one has contacted me on this specific issue, but I would anticipate it could happen. Someone saying, well, there was a license plate number, and that's enough. That's enough to show whose car it belonged to.
Chambers says having a license plate might be enough for civil liability, but that's about it. An independent review shows former McLean County Board Chairman Matt Sorensen committed no wrongdoing in his role on the county board as he faces federal wire fraud charges related to his private consulting work. State's Attorney Jason Chambers says he ordered the probe as a precaution. Sorensen allegedly billed more than $400,000 from companies, including State Farm, for work that was never done. Sorensen has pleaded not guilty. He resigned from his county board seat in January, though he won the primary election for his board seat on Tuesday against four write-in candidates. And the lead write-in candidate, who was appointed to that county board seat in January, Scott Murphy, says now the decision is in Matt's hands.
I believe that Matt will do the honorable thing when it's known what the honorable thing is. And right now, I don't know what that is, whether he's going to come through the situation that he's in If he's not convicted of a felony, he can certainly go back on the board.
In a long time, McLean County board member was ousted this week as Ben Owens lost to Josh Barnett. Barnett says his message resonated with voters.
People were looking for a candidate who would eagerly promote economic development, would work hard to bring transparency to our county government, and would be a watchful steward of their tax dollars.
After the loss, Owens says he's unsure about running for another political office.
As I've always thought in my mind, and I've always said that, you know, it's out of my control. My future is in God's hands, so it just, we move forward, and what he wants to do in my life, he will do.
And McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael was working on Election Day to dispel rumors that Illinois State's Bone Student Center had been running short on ballots.
We've never run out of ballots. I think emotions are running high at ISU, and they all need to take a deep breath and carry on and get used to standing in line.
And residents of a senior and disabled housing complex in Bloomington are trying to save their bus stop. Tony Grant of Phoenix Towers tells WJBC Connect Transit's plans to eliminate a route in front of the apartment building will make it more difficult for residents to get to their doctor's appointments and will add to their financial distress and isolation.
I hear my residents often state things like they help make Bloomington normal what it is today off of their labor and their hard work. And now that they're in their sunset of their years, they want to make sure that they still have access to the services that they have within the community.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Normalstown Council will consider a water rate increase. On Tuesday, a man from Normal, Tracy Newsom, faces sentencing for the shooting death of Carlton Jordan in Bloomington in November of 2014. On Wednesday, Tory Washington of Bloomington will face sentencing for his role in the beating death of a homeless veteran, Ronald Smith, in June of 2014. Wednesday is also Pro Day for Illinois State football. A group of seniors will work out with pro scouts at Hancock Stadium. And remember, Easter comes early this year. It's next Sunday, the 27th of March. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Starr.